You're listening to a Hebrew in Israel podcast with Yoel Halevi, exploring the language, culture, and history of the Bible. For more information, visit us at HebrewInIsrael.net.
Shalom, everyone. Welcome back to another episode of Tzohar LaMikra. We are drawing near to the end of this series, though I might actually redo few episodes of Bamidbar, which were the way I started, and we will probably expand on those a little bit more because they're only about 15-20 minutes long. But as I said, we actually are drawing towards the end of the series, and there already is a plan to develop another series that will deal with something different, probably more focused on Hebrew. And I'm also going to put out some more videos to expand on the subject of Hebrew and word studies and everything. But for today, we are going to continue with our weekly cycle. So for this recording this week, we are in Parashat Emor. And Parashat Emor is basically a continuation of Kedoshim. Kedoshim is more towards the people, more for the general public, more for everyone else. Emor already focuses with very similar laws, but also with some extra special laws on the Kohanim. Now, while I'm recording this, I'm actually producing this recording during Chag HaMatzot. I have less of a workload, so I decided to push the recordings into this period. And actually, during this week, there was a very controversial subject that came up in Jewish circles with the Reform movement. Now, there's a lot I can say about the Reform movement. You can go online and read about them. They do cite, like, in my opinion, at least, they slightly misrepresent who they actually are, because they make certain claims, but at the end of the day, and that they draw people in, but at the end of the day, personally knowing people in the Reform movement, and also knowing people who decide to join the movement because they were looking for a way to join Judaism, and then they discover it's not what they think it is. And the Reform movement, as it's known, is a reforming movement. They decide to change things from the traditional way. Now, what they did this week was already not a change inside the structure of Judaism, as they're the practices of Judaism, what you find in Orthodoxy. They tried to change something in Torah itself. And that was a very big red line for me, because I can understand the argument of women's equality in synagogue and in the public sphere of, you know, women functioning as types of rabbis or community leaders. That less bothers me, because I really, you know, I think that throughout the centuries, there were women who led their communities, and I don't think there's anything wrong with that. I think that the idea of pushing women out of certain places is completely wrong. There are even areas where I think men really have nothing to do there, maybe more as a theoretical advisors, specifically, for example, the laws of Nida, which I decided to start doing series with my wife instead of just me talking about this, because we need a woman's perspective on this. And, you know, if you haven't listened to that yet, we actually have one episode up to now, which is Loz Nida Part 1. And women who've listened to the program contacted me and said thank you, because they said it's really the first time someone has actually put out something with a woman's voice. But what happened with the Reform movement, what they did this time, and this is really already trying to undermine the structure of Torah, is they wanted to do what's known as a priestly blessing, but actually have women do it. And this is already a red line. This is a place where, you know, we can be open about a whole bunch of stuff, but this is already not in Torah. The people who functioned in the temple were men. The people who did the priestly blessing were men. Women who were married to Kohanim or daughters of Kohanim had a place in society. They were allowed to consume certain parts of the tumot, not really tithes, but tumot, which were brought to the husband. They were very respected in society because of the husband's place. But they never actually worked in the temple. I won't be surprised if women would go to the wife of a Kohen to ask laws the same way people ask today what's known as the rabbi's wife. I don't want to use the term rebbetzin because it's too European. And as being a person who lives in Israel and lives, for example, the building I live in, we have people from a lot of different backgrounds. And, my family technically comes from Europe, though we lately discovered that we're not really European. It's a complex subject, but, I don't perceive myself as being Ashkenazi anymore. It's really, I'm just, Jewish. And that's the way I see it. And I've been trying to break down these walls for years. And hopefully one day a change will come. But it's quite possible that the wife of a Kohen, she wasn't referred to as a Kohenic. It's actually a pagan term, because there is no such thing as a female temple practitioner in Torah. It does not exist. We find a case, for example, of women who are avid supporters of temple functions, and usually it was in a very negative context, such as Ataliah, the priest. She basically functioned as a priestess when she took over the throne of Judea just before King Joash. And then you also have Izebel or Jezebel. Her name was probably Jezebel, and they changed it to Izebel, which, from being a priestess of God, it turns into prostitute of something. I can't remember exactly how it was changed. Not a big expert in Phoenician. And, so the context is always very negative. It doesn't mean that there's a negative approach towards women. This is something that people need to understand. But, at the end of the day, when it comes to Torah, if we're people who believe in the Torah and accept what it says, then this really had no place. Obviously, a lot of people protested against this. People said, "Listen, there is no, not even, you know, not even the most, historical anywhere, and so on. Is there actually any such status?" And at the end of the day, if a woman will go in and try to adorn the clothing of a priest and try to serve there, her actions will be considered inappropriate and unacceptable. And that's just the reality of what it is. Obviously, today with Western culture, people try to push feminism and equality in places where it's not always the same. There's this. I actually was listening to someone who made a point that that the feminist movement, though I think the call to liberty for women is obviously a good thing. Giving women a place in much bigger places is perfectly fine. But at the end of the day, someone made a very interesting point that you only find the feminist movement trying to push women in prestigious places, but you never hear about them saying, "Oh, okay, let's let women work in, physical labor, like really hard physical labor." And you don't find women wanting to go in and work as garbage disposal management, or working in jobs which are pretty difficult and dirty. And you don't hear anything like this. You go into a repair shop, a car repair shop. You go in, the number of women who actually work there is extremely low. And again, it might there can be a whole bunch of different things that might be about it, but when I look at the movement and I look at what they're really trying to promote, it's mostly trying to squeeze women into places where it's prestigious, instead of saying, if you're going to go for equality, then let's go into equality in everything. And this is probably why they went to this whole Birkat Kohanot thing they wanted to push. They're trying to push into prestigious places. But then I'll ask the question, so are you willing to become a shochet? Are you willing to do ritual slaughter and deal with all the guts and gore of doing that? Are you willing to be a mohelet, to do circumcision? Are you willing to to do all these more dirty jobs that mostly men are in? And I think the answer would most definitely would be no. So there is something very distorted with the way they approach this. But we do see that there is such a status of a Bat Kohen and Eshet Kohen, which are people who are seen as being a higher level in society, and they do have a place. And it seems to be, these are families that deal with Torah all the time. These are families that the fathers and the brothers are involved in the temple, and obviously things will rub off. And you know, I know of families where the husband is a very important rabbi, and the wife knows quite a bit to an extent that sometimes, you know, if the rabbi can't answer, sometimes the wife, you know, she's a Talmid Chacham by her own right. She absorbs from her husband everything that he studies, so she gets very knowledgeable as well. So you know, it's trying to find honor in places where honor is not suitable is very, very childish, and this is somewhat I see with this type of behavior. So I had to say something about this because it disturbed me very deeply, because this is no longer an issue of, you know, women's equality in the right places. It became a farce of trying to really change Torah, and that really bothered me. And I think that we need to say something. At a certain point, enough is enough. It doesn't work like that. In any case, so Parashat Emor, as I said, is basically like Parashat Kedoshim, and the thing is that we actually see very similar laws, but then they're a little different. Now, as a reminder, I actually have a discussion on my website on the used to be blog, now it's articles, about beards 1 and beards 2, which discusses the difference between, for example, what we have in Kedoshim in chapter 19 and what we have in Parashat Emor in chapter 21. But basically, the Kohanim, because they are the again, I don't know if this necessarily is a caste system the same way you had in all ancient societies, but there is this very important side of when you are representative of the people, you need to look and behave in a certain way. So, for example, if I go out and I'm on a trip with a group, for example, there are groups that come to Israel and I join them, you know, I can't show up with a torn t-shirt, which, by the way, I don't own torn t-shirts, but I can't show up with a torn t-shirt and a pair of shorts and flippy flops or something. You know, when you are representative of Torah, when you're as a teacher, as a person of knowledge, as a, in my case, also a Levite, you can't show up looking in rags. You can't be like one of these, you know, oh, feel good guys. It's as much as you want to be very flowing and happy and everything, you have to show up in a certain way. So, for example, when I go out to a lecture with a group, I have to wear a button-up shirt and a pair of trousers, which are suitable, and actually wear a pair of shoes as well. And when I'm with a group on a tour, for example, you know, it's more acceptable that I wear a t-shirt and things like that. But still, there is a certain dress code I have to follow, you know, and you have to keep yourself kind of clean and organized and everything. So you have to make sure you clean yourself up, and you know, if you trim your beard or something, to bring the shaving kit with you and everything, because there's a certain status you're looking for when you're looking at people that are supposed to be your representatives. You're looking for a certain form. You don't want your prime minister, when he's in office and he goes out to meet with other countries, that he's going to show up again with a torn shirt, pair of shorts, and the flippy floppies. If he's on vacation or something, you know, it's one thing. But you know, for example, Vladimir Putin had pictures of him without a shirt. You know, he was riding a horse without a shirt. Now, that's Russian culture. It's a little different, but people made a lot of fun of this. This was a couple of years back. People made a lot of fun of this, because what kind of a prime minister takes pictures without a shirt on? And that's kind of basically what we're looking at here. The description here of how Kohanim are supposed to look and behave is basically what's expected of people who are representatives of God on earth, which, by the way, fits also to all of us, that if we are followers of Torah, we're supposed to show a certain level of honor and respect, and not bring shame to our Creator through our behavior and look. Now, it doesn't mean that we need to completely change our culture and completely change who we are to appease anyone. We don't need to appease anyone whatsoever. We need to stick to our culture as well. But yelling and screaming and behaving like an animal because you think you're holier than others, because you're a Torah keeper, is not what we're looking for here. You have to choose how to behave at each occasion. For example, if someone's, you know, asking you about Torah and they're being a little cheeky about it, then you still can pass on and talk in a mild manner. But when people become violent and everything, obviously it's your right to protect yourself and it's your right to do certain things. And if someone films this and says, look, this is how religious people behave, they're being hypocritical here because they're only showing one side of the situation, which is, by the way, very, very similar to what's going on with the state of Israel these days, how media and propaganda misappropriate how things actually happen. And then the real video comes out, but it's too late. So, but you need to remember that there's a balance you have to keep. You know, a Torah keeper, you don't have to always, I'm not saying you have to dress in a certain way and so on, but you need to be kind of careful with how you behave and what you say and what you do. And there's, for example, one of the conflicts that we have here, specifically in Israel all the time, is looking at religious people and you know, people judging. Now, I personally, you know, have a relatively mild manner when I deal with people, and I try to be, you know, clean and organized and so on, and people actually respect that, you know. And on the other hand, there are people who are very wise and very very good in understanding Torah and everything, but they choose to behave in a certain way, or they choose to dress in a certain way, or look a certain way, and they think that they're following Torah. They think that they are, you know, this makes them, makes them real Torah followers, and it's really just trying to feel special. So I know people who wear robes, and people who grow wild beards and wild hair, and you know, people who have beards that look, you know, really Rastafari type of beards, and others, they have these dreadlocks in the beards and everything, because they never really attend to their beards. And they look terrible, basically. And people don't respect that. People, when they look at a Torah keeper, or they look at a religious person, that and they live in a mixed society. We're not talking about strong ethnic societies where, you know, for example, you go to India and a yogi looks, you know, paints himself white and puts a funny symbol on symbol on his forehead, and he looks terrible, and the hair is terrible. But people in India respect that because that's expected of, you know, the yogis. But on the other hand, when you live in diverse ethnic backgrounds, when you live in a place where there are diverse opinions and so on, you're going to have a problem. If they're going to look at this individual and say, listen, we can't respect that. We can't respect a person that doesn't respect himself by looking so bad. So this is kind of what basically happens here with the Kohanim and also with Israel. We have, you know, laws, very similar laws in chapter 19, don't cut yourself, don't rip out your beard when you're in mourning, don't tattoo yourself, because that basically that's deforming the body. It has literally nothing to do with idol worshiping or with worshiping the dead. There's the only connection we can find historically is to do with servitude. This is when people tattooed themselves, that these were actually symbols of servants. These were actually symbols for slaves. And the Torah forbids that. We're not slaves. We are the chosen people of God. We follow Torah, and we are free and actually a royal type of people. Now, what's interesting here is that there actually is a division between Kohanim, regular Kohanim, and a Kohen Gadol. So the first prohibition we have here is coming in contact with the dead. So we know that an irregular Israelite can come, even a Levite can come in contact with the dead, bury them, go into cemeteries and everything. And all they have to do is get sprinkled with ashes of red heifer, and they're good. Kohanim, on the other hand, have very big restrictions. And Kohanim to this very day practice this. A Kohen will never be caught in a cemetery, even if it's a funeral of a relative. The cemeteries in Jewish circles are built in such a way where the sections where Kohanim are buried, I'm talking about the massive cemetery in Jerusalem on Givat Shaul, that's a whole subject by itself, but many Jewish cemeteries actually have the priestly section near the fence, so the family can actually stand from outside of the fence and still participate in the funeral without actually going into the cemetery itself. But the Torah says that they're not supposed to come in contact with the dead except for direct relatives. And what's very interesting here is the sister who is still a virgin. In other words, a sister that has not moved outside of the family. women, when they got married, there's basically kind of like an adoption process here that when a woman gets married, she no longer belongs to the family she was in, that she was born into. Now she belongs to the other family, and the other family basically adopts her. So it's the responsibility now of that, the husband's family, and obviously the husband himself, to take care of the wife at, or the daughter-in-law as her own. There's a protective system here. Women are a protected group inside Israelite society, and it is the responsibility. And if that, for example, the husband's family or the husband do not take care of the wife, there is a very good chance that there was actually a judicial system, a judicial process where the family of the bride can actually take the family of the groom to court because they're not fulfilling what they have to do. And marriage, we'll do a separate recording about marriage, but marriage is also very strongly based on contracts, which means you have to do certain things. And for example, a husband that abuses his wife is not fulfilling his job. And if she, for example, complains to a judge or complains to her family, they can actually do something about it. Now, when a Kohen is mourning his member of family, so there are basically seven members of family: father, mother, brother, sister who is a virgin, son and daughter. Wife apparently is not one of them, which is very, very peculiar. It's, and it says in verse 4, Lo yitameh ba'al be'amav, a husband will not be unclean in his family, because the word am here means family, le'echalo, to desecrate himself. It's very interesting, this root chalal here, to desecrate, repeats itself several times. They're not supposed to pull, you know, lo yikrechu kal habil osham, they were not supposed to make a bald spot, meaning pull out their hair, which kind of gives us indications of what were the mourning practices in the ancient Near East. Now, this is very important because the root used here is galach, which is to shave, which means an Israelite that shaves as a sign of mourning is perfectly fine, with, unless you want to argue that these are complete parallels and shahat and galach are the same, but really these are different roots and they're actually born in different sections. So my argument is that in Israel, he's allowed to shave his beard as a sign of mourning, which is very interesting because it's very different than what we find in modern day in Judaism, where a person who's mourning is not allowed to trim their hair and not allowed to shave their beard. And actually, in the ancient Near East, it was the opposite. If you removed your hair, you removed your hair, you removed your beard, now you actually have a sign of mourning. And it's very interesting because people in the ancient world actually grew long hair, and long hair, which was nice and tidy and organized, and a nice tidy beard, that was actually, it was long beard, but organized and tidy. Maybe some men even braided their hair. That was actually something which was honorable. It was like basically wearing, you know, a tuxedo or something to an event. The way you groomed yourself was something that symbolized your social status as well. So an Israelite is not supposed to, you know, pull out his hair or shave his beard unless, you know, shaving beard could be something which is allowed to do during mourning. Completely shaving your head can be a sign of mourning as well. But a Kohen, because Kohanim are in service, they're not supposed to pull out their hair or basically make a bald spot, which means also shave their heads. And they're not supposed to shave their beard, and they're not supposed to cut themselves. They will not make lesions, they will not make cuts in their flesh. So these actually kind of give us indication of what people did as signs of mourning in the ancient Near East as well. And it states why they're not supposed to do this, because they are kedushim Elohim, they are holy, they shall be holy to their God, and they will not desecrate the name of their God. This is what I said earlier, that as a representative of God, if you don't look a certain way, if you're not organized in a certain way, you are actually desecrating the name of your God. So if you're a teacher, you need to show up on stage with a sports jacket or something, or at least, you know, a button-up shirt and be organized. And by the way, they're in Christianity, you know, we hear later on about all these holy men that look, you know, they're people who don't bathe themselves and things like that. This is the exact opposite. A lot of the ideology of what a holy man is, the way we find it later on, especially after Christianity, is, I think, very contrary to what we find in what we find in the Torah. The only group that we find which are supposed to look wild are the Nazarites. But that's a way to mark themselves. And it's under very, very specific rules. But a person who is an official, a person who's born into official work, has to behave in a certain way. A Nazarite, the way they grow their wild hair and wild beards, is something symbolic. It's maybe even growing the wild hair is symbolic of them doing something which is outside of the order of society. And they mark themselves as being holier men for a short while, but also showing the disorder of being, this is not how we naturally are. A lot of people ask me about the Nazarite. It's not a very simple thing to answer exactly what the point is. And it points out, Isha zonah v'halala lo ikachu, v'isha grusha m'isha lo ikachu, ki kadosh hu le'elohav. This is verse 7. It says, and a woman who is a prostitute or desecrated. Now, zonah is clearly a prostitute, regardless of all the different discussions they have in Talmud and everything. Zonah basically means a woman who is a prostitute, and there's a big question about prostitution in Israel. It was really forbidden or not forbidden. There's a verse that says in Deuteronomy, "Lo techel bitcha leaznotal." Basically, we don't desecrate your daughter to make her into a prostitute. But then there's the question of what if a woman, because what if a woman decides to become a prostitute? And it has nothing to do with their father. Is that allowed as well? And we find stories about, prostitutes that existed in Israel. And there's a big, de I don't know if it's a big debate, but there's a question looming about this entire thing. What exactly is the prohibition of Torah? I don't know what the answer is. This is another one of those like little weird questions that hover out there. But I'll say that the verse in Deuteronomy, I think, would be an overall prohibition on prostitution, because it used to be that mostly young girls were sold by the families. We know this from documents which were found. There's one document from a Phoenician document that was discovered of a man that did a deal to sell his daughter for to be a prostitute. And this was a very, very unfortunate way for very poor families to at least make sure that, they have some money and the daughter goes into an institution that would, as horrible as it sounds to us, it was considered back then to be a legitimate thing to do to make sure the child has somewhere to live. The Torah says this is forbidden. This is wrong to do. Do not do this to your children. The Torah actually goes out to protect children's rights in a world where children were basically a commodity to many families, which is for us today is very sad, and unfortunately still goes on in the world in many, many countries around the world. And what's even sadder is that I read these reports about human trafficking, and there are people in the Western world that are involved in this. So if there's an organization, I think you should support our organizations that fight human trafficking very clearly. It's a horrible, horrible, horrible thing. And the Torah even gives in Exodus, it says that if a person kidnaps another person to sell them, that person can be executed. That's how harsh the Torah is about disrespecting human rights. Halala is a good question, what exactly a halala is. So in rabbinic circles, they want to argue that this is a convert. The answer is most definitely not, because that's not what the word means. A halala is probably something which is parallel to a prostitute, basically a loose woman, a woman who is known to being very disrespectful of herself and basically sleeping around. So halala is a desecrated woman. Some people want to say also might mean a woman that was raped. That's also a possibility, though I think the sitting together, the whole zonah and halala side by side, probably means something which is more out of will. But we do find harsh rulings when it comes, for example, to a Kohen's daughter that goes and sleeps with a man without being married to him. So it's possible halala is a general term for women who have been desecrated either by will or unfortunately through rape. Grusha is a divorced woman. So really what comes out of this is that a coin is basically really allowed to marry a really allowed to marry either a virgin or a widow. And there is really nothing in between. What I find very interesting is why specifically a divorcee? So it's quite possible, again, that this goes into the whole discussion of why did people actually get divorced? And the question is, could there be something in the divorce that actually has to do with something sexual misconduct by the woman's side? There's the very famous debate of, you know, how come people get divorced? And it says in Deuteronomy, if a man finds dvar erva, a thing of covering, and erva also can mean something to do with the reproductive organs. And from there, many people conclude that the only reason to get divorced, if there's a certain sexual act that was forbidden from the wife's side. But I think that, and really the context here, no, everything here in this sequence has to do with sexual behavior, that actually might support that argument. Though there are many people argue that really what it means is anything of misconduct in general, something which can bring disrespect to the husband in a harsh way. You know, things which are very problematic. There's just no, they have an argument, he decides to divorce her. That there could be something very, very problematic. But this field of divorce is again very complex. And I'm actually, I've been studying several articles and actually an entire book that's dedicated to try to explain some of these things. And I find a lot of questions, a lot of difficulties with this subject. And people sometimes ask me questions about these things. And I say, listen, you really need to go and ask someone who's a functioning man of law, a person who actually has real cases come before him. But I will say something very, very simple, that speaking with lawyers and rabbis who deal with this type of stuff, it happens to be that a lot of the divorce cases, or I don't know, many of them, I don't know what percentage, but many of them actually come from that problem, from sexual misconduct from one of the sides. So it's quite possible the Torah is talking about the most common reason for divorce, but not the only reason. And as we said, you know, there can be a lot of these gray areas and so on. Again, complex subject. There are many of these little black areas, you know, these little dark areas that we don't necessarily know what the answer is. And it's difficult. People say to me, oh, the Torah is not supposed to be confusing. When you work in this field for 20 years, you know, it's almost been 20 years for me, you discover that there actually are a lot of gray areas and places where we can only fill in the blanks through knowledge, external knowledge. So we have, you know, in verse 9, we have this law that has to do with the daughter of a Kohen. The daughter of, this actually indicates, you know, the harsh punishment, as harsh as this may sound, it also gives us indication of how important the daughter of a Kohen actually is. Then we have the Kohen Gadol, and the Kohen Gadol is that he's taken up another notch, and he's forbidden for coming. He's forbidden from doing any acts that represent mourning. He's not even allowed to undo his hair and tear his clothing. He cannot come in contact with any of his relatives when they die. He's not allowed to leave the temple. Now, this, by the way, is a big question. What does it mean not leave the temple? Is he not allowed to leave the temple at all, or is this, yeah, he's allowed to leave the temple when necessary, but for this action, he's not allowed to leave the temple. And I've had people write to me, say, oh, the Kohen Gadol is not supposed to leave the temple, period. Now, I'll say something like this. He's the highest ranking officiant in the temple itself. And it makes a lot of sense that he will be in the temple most of the time. But I don't think it meant that he's not allowed to leave the temple, period. I think that the point being made here is that he's not allowed to leave the temple for this action of the morning, so there won't be any question about him desecrating himself by coming in contact with the dead. So really, the Kohen Gadol is really the only person in Israel who never becomes unclean with that, because he's needing the temple 24/7. But what this also indicates, and we can actually correlate this together with some information about Eliyahu Kohen from Shiloh, and Yehoyada, We mentioned Ataliah earlier. So Yehoyada was the high priest. He was referred to as Kohen Harosh, which means he was the high priest and he was the leader. And he was also a very strong spiritual leader. He killed Ataliah. But what's interesting is that he hides King Yoash or Yehoash in Chadar HaMitot. Now, the Midrash talks about the idea that this is, you know, somewhere in the temple, you know, the second story of the temple and everything. But what really this probably means is that he hid him in his own chambers, which were probably in the temple complex. The story of Eli and the story of Yehoyada in the Book of Kings probably indicate that the Kohen Gadol actually did live in the temple the whole time, or the majority of the time, and he was always needed in the premise. In the premises. But what's very interesting as well is that in the second temple, they actually had a special room known as Yishkat Kohen Gadol, which was a symbolic house the Kohen Gadol would live in, because many of the Kohanim actually were very wealthy people and they went to live in their own palaces, their own mansions. But they also had a symbolic house that they would dwell in during the 7 days before Yom Kippurim. So that actually indicates that there was originally a room, a housing for the high priest in the temple itself. So this kind of gives us also an indication of where it's expected the high priest will actually live. And he's only allowed to marry, a virgin. It actually says that a widow, a divorcee, a chalala, which we discussed earlier, and a zona, which was a prostitute, he is not allowed to marry them at all. Now, what's interesting about this is what happens with an Israelite. Can an Israelite marry a chalala and a zona? And the answer is probably yes. For example, if a woman, unfortunately, or is promiscuous, or worked as a prostitute, and left that world and repented, she's accepted back into Israelite circles. She is not to be shamed for what she did. She has repented. She has removed herself from that world, and you are allowed to marry such a woman because of the fact that she has repented. She is now no longer in that world anymore. And that's a very, very important note. You are not allowed to remind people of their past behavior. I think this is a very, very important social note that we need to remember. We might have known someone who behaved in a certain way. And even if it's not a religious thing, it was a person who had abhorrent behavior. And that person has now has left that way. And it can be completely secular as well. Has completely left that way. And now keeps behaving in a proper way, or keeps keeping Torah and everything. We are not allowed to remind that person of what they did in the past. They know what they did. Never use that against them. I think that's one of the messages we can pull out of this text as well. Then we have, again, a series of things that disqualify someone from actually working as a temple servant. And again, this builds into what I said, that there's a certain way people are supposed to look. But again, with our Western culture, you know, give everyone an equal chance and everything. So this is not something that that Westerners will actually understand. But there are deformities here, which I actually find to be very interesting. For example, if they broke their hand or leg, you know, does that disqualify them forever, or does it disqualify them only at the time when they are in this state? Now, it seems to be that the description ki yevo shever regel shever yad, that's verse 19, yevo probably means at the time. So if they have a broken hand or broken leg or broken arm, they're not supposed to work, but after that, when they heal and they heal properly, then they probably can return to work. But there are things here which disqualify people from functioning as kohanim. It doesn't take away from their rights. It just means they can't actually work directly in the temple. So there are, you know, people who are limp, blind, hunchback. The word duck here is verse 20 is not very clear what duck is. Some people say maybe it means someone who's a midget. I don't know. Deformities in the eyes, deformities of the skin and everything. And again, this is very awkward for people from the Western culture, but in Eastern cultures, this doesn't, it's not demeaning to these people. It's just inside this specific structure, they're not supposed to work, but the rights of being a Kohen, they're not supposed to, not allowed to do work, but all the perks of being a Kohen, they still receive. And this is an important point to make out. They can't go and work on the altar because they have, in many cases, you know, a blind person can't go up to the altar. He won't be able to see what he's doing. Or physical limitations. We're not going to force you to do this. But all the perks of being a Kohen, they still preserve. They're supposed to eat from the sacrifices, receive the Tehumot, and they can do everything else except for actually working in the temple itself. There are a whole load of things here as well about, you know, becoming unclean from different things. For example, it says in verse 8 that Nevela Trefa, this is chapter 22, verse 8, a Nevela Trefa, Nevela is an animal that dropped dead. Trefa is a torn animal, was torn by a wild animal. They're not supposed to eat. Some people try to extrapolate out of this that an Israelite is allowed to eat these things, but it's really just reinforcing a law that also applies to Israelites. So what does it mean, an animal that dropped dead? So there's a big debate about this, you know, when it comes to what does it mean to have kosher food? So, a nevela is usually understood to be, an animal that just, you find a carcass of an animal, a dead animal, and that's a nevela. Or trefa is a whole bunch of different things which appear in rabbinic law that make it into a trefa, which doesn't mean an animal was torn, it wasn't torn by a wild animal, it's actually died. It has a potential of dying because of some problem with their physique, you know, missing lungs, missing kidneys, you know, whatever it might be. But really the text itself, what it's actually talking about is finding dead animals of different sorts and not eating them because these animals are, but even if it's a clean animal when they're alive and they're slaughtered the right way, now they're actually going to be unclean if they just die. But what's interesting about this is that it reinforces this, but it has led some scholars to argue that did lead a lot of scholars to think, oh, maybe regular Israelites are allowed, but actually emphasize this, it's forbidden. So I'm saying a lot of the laws here, when it comes to the Kohanim, when it comes to Israel, are also being mirrored into the Kohanim themselves, but it's being stressed more and more. Now, again, there's laws here about the daughter of a Kohen, and, you know, if she gets married, different people are in the household of a Kohen, what they're allowed and forbidden to do. So, for example, if he has, you know, strangers in his house, people who are just dwelling with him, a toshav or a sachir, these are people who are sitting with him for a while, people that he rented from the outside to work with him. So toshav can be an Israelite as well. I mean, toshav is a term that's usually used to describe a foreigner, a person who is not an Israelite. But here the term a toshav and a sachir probably are used to describe Israelites and non-Israelites simultaneously. So these are guests in his house, and therefore they are not part of the family structure. But on the other hand, if he actually has someone that he purchases, obviously in the world where slavery was allowed, and slavery in the Torah, by the way, is used, it seems to be used mostly to punish people or for people to find a way out of poverty by selling themselves. And I mentioned this in my podcast about Parashat Mishpatim. It's actually, I think, one of the first things I talk about there, maybe one of the main things I talk about there as well. But if a person, for some reason or other, becomes a slave, and by the way, I point out there that today we send people to prison. Back then, they wouldn't send them to prison. They would just send them to be slaves, to educate them. So there's an educational element there as well. So that person is considered to be as if he's, you know, part of the family. So he's allowed to eat from whatever the Kohen receives as part of his position as a Kohen. A Yelid Bait is also a child that's born inside the family. As a, for example, we have a servant and he gets married and he has children. Those children are part of the larger structure of the family. So it's very interesting. A regular free Israelite and a regular free Levite are forbidden to touch anything that belongs to a Kohen. But then a person who is a servant suddenly is allowed. And again, I think this speaks volumes about what exactly is slavery in the Torah. And it's not what you find in other cultures. You take care of your slave. You're supposed to take care of them. If you harm them, they actually can be set free. You don't have complete authority over your slaves. And not only that, you need to take care of them. And here, if you're a slave of a Kohen, you are allowed to partake in even, you know, the challah, which is the bread that's brought to a Kohen, and the fruits, and maybe even some of the meat. That's a good question, exactly. Exactly everything that they're allowed to eat. But it says, yochlo ben lachmo, in verse 11, lachmo means all of his food. They can partake in all of his food. So this is a very, very interesting reality here. A daughter of a Kohen, as we said earlier, if she is a... if she's been married, if she got married, she's been taken outside of the family. And therefore, when she returns to her husband's family, if she becomes a widow or she gets divorced, and she has no children, then she's not really been completely removed from her family. But more, there are children. Her children are named after her husband's family, and therefore she no longer has the name of her father anymore upon her. But the interesting thing here is that the question I raise is, what if a daughter of a Kohen marries another Kohen? She's still inside the Kohen structure. So if, for example, she gets divorced or widowed, she was already in a Kohen family. She never lost her earlier status. She just switched families. So now she doesn't get expelled out because she never changed her status. So could it be that in a situation like that, if she actually does have children, and by the way, the Mishnah actually discusses this, if her husband dies or divorces her, but she has children, then she actually continues to receive portions of Kohanim probably through her children. Her children are to give her from what she has. But also it's probably possible that she returns to her father's house because her status never ever changed. She was a daughter of a Kohen, now she's a wife of a Kohen, but she never left the structure of Kohanim. She actually might continue to be a beneficiary of being a Kohen. Now, what's very, very important here, and this parasha also has the entire section about the feasts and the sacrifices of the feasts and everything, and we even have the story of the blasphemer here, which is a very, very famous story. I'll skip over the feast and I'll go to the blasphemer for a moment. But what's very important here as well, so if a person, for example, puts a tithe aside or puts, no, not a tithe, but again, things which are supposed to give into a coin, because ma'asel is not what you give to a coin. Ma'asel is a completely different thing. It was, as I point out all the time, it was stolen in the Second Temple period from the hands of the Levites and never restored. That's just basically a historical reality, a historical fact. What's interesting is if a person consumes by mistake something which was supposed to be for a Kohen, they have to give back the equivalent of what was taken, also add a fifth, which basically means they return 120%. I've had people try to discuss, does it return, you know, that plus that? They start putting all these math attempts to add more and more, and I say, no, they return 120%. There's the 100%, and then you add a chamishit, which is a fifth, which means 20%. So it's not that you add 120% on top of that, another fifth or something. No, it's 100% and then another 20%, which makes it a total of 120% if you consume by mistake something which belongs to a Kohen. Now, this famous story of the blasphemer is a very, very interesting story because it's also, first of all, it's a comment about people who, first of all, the people who are not completely born Israelite, kind of a warning to Israel regarding people who are, they join Israel for the wrong reasons. Now, this man is an Egyptian. So his father's an Egyptian, his mother's an Israelite. And an Israelite man, a completely Israelite man from both parents, and he's referred to as Isha Yisraeli. Basically says that there were two people, Veitzeh ben Isha Yisraeli, v'hu ben Ish Mitzri, and the man who was his mother, he's a son of an Israelite woman, but his father is an Egyptian. And he's inside the children of Israel, which means he's joined the children of Israel for whatever reason it might be, probably out of fear of what happened, and instead of identifying with his Egyptian heritage, because we know that historically speaking, the genealogy went through the fathers. This person is considered to be an Egyptian in truth, but he joined Israel, so he kind of basically, I would say, converted, quote unquote, to becoming an Israelite. But he still has a very strong identity as an Egyptian, and he fights with he fights with an Ish Yisraeli. They struggled. Ben Yisrael v'Isha Yisraeli, the son of the Israelite woman and the Israelite man. So the Israelite man is obviously both parents were Israelites, or at least the father was an Israelite. So the son of the Egyptian man, who is also referred to as the son of the Israelite woman. It's interesting that the idea that he is the son of an Egyptian man, it's actually parenthetical. It's actually a parenthetical clause there, mentioning, by the way, his father was not an Israelite. And he vaykovet Hashem vaykaled. He said the name of God, the Tetragrammaton, and he cursed. Okay, he basically says the name and curses, and that's basically what we call blasphemy. Blasphemy is not every sacrilegious behavior. Blasphemy has very specific criteria. But what's very, very interesting is what happens with the meaning of what happened here. Because it says, first of all, they stone him and everything. You can read this by yourself. But it says in verse 15, verse 16, this is a verse that there's a lot of debate about. This is, V'nokev shem Adonai mot yumat. Ragom yirgimu v'kol ha'edah k'ger k'ezach v'nokvo shem yumat. And he who proclaims the name will surely be put to death. He will be stoned by all the congregation as a sojourner and as a native born. When he proclaims the name, he will be put to death. Now, when I take the word nokev, which is the root here, because vayikov, which we have in verse 11, is really from the root nakav. If I take this verse just by itself without the context, you automatically think, oh, the root nakav here is to proclaim, to mention. And therefore, mentioning God's name is completely and utterly forbidden. And people use this verse over and over again. I think this is, when I started teaching Hebrew, this was one of the first verses a lot of people brought before me, students and people that came in contact with me, because they kept on hearing this verse. And then, I have friends who are big advocates of using God's name, of proclaiming God's name. And people wrote this verse, and they said, listen, yes, the root nakav can mean to mention, but it can also mean to curse. And this is the thing. This is a double meaning here. It doesn't mean just to proclaim God's name. It means to proclaim in a blasphemous way. So nokev actually can be translated, if we use it in more modern English term, should be blasphemy. This is not just mentioning the name. This is mentioning the name in a blasphemous way. But this can only be understood if we read the entire section in context. The story is brought here deliberately to clarify what's prohibited here. Because on the other hand, we have verses that clearly state that you are to use God's name when you take an oath. You're not supposed to use God's name in vain, in the sense of don't use it in something which is a lie, something which is vanity. But using God's name was something people did. And we know this as a fact. There are even historical documents that we can present where people actually wrote down the name of God. And the way letters worked is that people dictated these letters and people wrote exactly what they heard. And we know this because we can see styles. We can have letters which are written by officials versus letters which are written by regular mundane people. And you can see that in the letters of the mundane people, they're just writing, they're rambling along. These people are not speaking in an organized fashion. Well, an official letter, for say, from a military officer is a lot more organized and clearly comes from people who can read and write. So their rhetoric is much cleaner. So we find these letters, like, for example, the letters from Lachish and the letters from Arad, especially the ones from Lachish, where they actually use oath formulas like Chai Yud Hei Vav here, where the word Chai is as lives, which is it's an oath formula that we find even in the Tanakh. The chet is attached to the name of God, and the yud is being doubly placed, where it belongs to the word chai and to the name of God. But this is an oath form that people used all the time. It wouldn't appear in a letter just because. It wasn't just some formula a writer would use. This was something people actually spoke. So we actually know a lot about the scribal traditions, the scribal systems that people used back then. And it seems to be very, very clear that they actually did use the name of God. And the prohibition of using the name of God, which is a very, you know, there's a lot of different opinions of how it happened, is something very, very late. But it seems to kind of show up the first time around the time of the return to Zion, basically in the late 6th century, early 5th century. Especially we know this because we find sections in places where there's a copying from the Book of Kings into the Book of Chronicles, and places where we have what's known as the Elohistic Psalms, where these are basically the Psalms which have duplicates in the Tanakh, as are duplicates in the Book of Psalms, and instead of the name of God, he actually the word Elohim. So it seems to be that they were substituting the name of God with the word Elohim. It seems to me this was something that started very early on and became more and more founded in certain circles, but there are probably other circles that objected to this. But in any case, what we actually have here is that the word nokev here does not mean just to proclaim or to pronounce. It actually is to pronounce and blaspheme simultaneously, and therefore this verse can never, ever, should and never should be used to argue that it's prohibited by Torah to pronounce the name of God. The prohibition seems to be more a practice, a custom, some kind of gzerah or takana at one point, by a decree, probably even before they were even rabbis, but a decree to forbid the pronunciation name of God, because people were trying to show a lot more respect. There's a very interesting structure about the Second Temple period, the early Second Temple period, which I am planning on talking about more in detail in the future. But I've thrown out bits and pieces about it in, you know, talking Torah, my oral Torah series, and also a historical background that I did there with Talking Torah and other places as well. But I'm planning on doing like my own podcast as well about that period to clarify some of the things that happened. In any case, I hope you enjoyed this recording. Don't forget to visit HebrewInIsrael.net. If what I do here has blessed you, please consider blessing me back by helping with donations. You can also visit me on the Facebook site, Hebrew in Israel, YouTube channel. Obviously, some people are going to be listening to this on YouTube as well, but don't forget Hebrew in Israel now on SoundCloud. You can go in. There's a free app you can download through either the Google Store or Google Play, or if you have an iPhone, through the iTunes Store, and you can go in and you can listen to all the recordings at your leisure. As far as I know, I mean, I kept it there. I told them to make it downloadable, so you should be able to download everything I do here. And as I said, I will be uploading, according to the Torah cycle, I will be uploading Bamidbar, Dvarim, and also Bereshit. Shmot is completely on the SoundCloud, Vayikra, based on recordings. And, there are other recordings I put up there. There are plenty of recordings I want to put up there, which will be very, very soon. But tell your friends, tell your family, sharing is caring. Liking is always very good because it helps promote the site, and it helps promote whatever function I'm working through. And in any case, I hope you enjoyed this. If you listen to this just before Shabbat or during Shabbat, Shabbat Shalom. If you're listening during the week, may you have a wonderful, blessed week and a wonderful, blessed day. Kol Tov.